Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we talk about the Ryzen 9 launch and its impact on the memory landscape. And what is up with this DDR5 memory anyway? I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain.
Dennis, lately I've been getting a lot of questions about PC upgrades, particularly because that new AMD processor's out. It's got everybody excited.
Oh yeah, the new Ryzen 9 and 7s and 6s and whatever.
That's right, the new Ryzen series. And of course, the performance for these is looking pretty great on paper. I know we haven't started a build yet based on the Ryzen 9 architecture.
No, we've been typically an Intel shop or an Intel reviewing shop. It's not because I am anti-AMD. It's just that those particular motherboards really never made it into the lab, so I didn't have an excuse to do that, except for the Threadripper. I do like Threadripper, even though it's slow and big and powerful.
Well, it's starting to get a little old. Well, most of the questions that I've been getting have been related to upgrades, particularly memory. In this case, you know, the Ryzen now supports DDR5.
Yes. So the new Ryzen 5, the 7950X3D, was just recently announced based off of when we recorded this podcast. And we have a chart here, so we can go down what got announced and how it relates to the latest Raptor Lake Intel processors.
Let's take a look.
So we have the 7950X3D, current pricing $700, give or take. It is a 16-core, 32-thread processor, so it has hyperthreading, which is not what AMD calls it, but it's basically the same thing.
Right.
We have the clocks start at 4.2 gigahertz, and they boost up to 5.7 gigahertz. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I can see why people are excited about it.
And this is the next part here is what a lot of people have been discussing, which is the onboard processor cache. And the amount of cache on a processor almost directly relates to memory performance and CPU performance. So the more cache memory you have and having it properly paired with your system memory, the more efficient your system will be.
That makes sense.
So on the Ryzen 9, the 7950X3D, we have 144 megs of level 2 and level 3 cache.
Now that sounds impressive. How does that compare to the Intel offerings?
Well, Intel kind of tops out around 68 megabytes.
Ooh, wow.
So this is almost double what that processor has. Now, if we go down to the Ryzen 9, the 7900X3D, this is a $600 processor. It has 12 cores with 24 threads. We have a 4.4 gigahertz base clock with a 5.6 gigahertz boost clock.
Still impressive.
And 140 megabytes of level 2 and level 3 cache. Now, both of those processors have a TDP of 120 watts, which is kind of average for a high-end processor nowadays. Now, if we go down even further, we have the Ryzen 9 7950X, not the X3D, but just the standard X. It has a price of $590. It's a 16-core, 32-thread, 4.5 gigahertz base clock with a 5.7 gigahertz boost clock, basically the exact same configuration as the X3D.
Right.
However, this one only has 80 megabytes of level 2 and level 3 cache.
Yeah, and the TDP is much hotter.
Yeah, it's 170 watts. So it makes you wonder what changed between the X and the X3D.
Well, it almost feels like the classic Intel TikTok, right? Like the 3D is the talk version of the 7950X. I wonder if that's the case.
I believe that that's probably, you hit the nail directly on the head. Now, also in this chart, we talk about the Ryzen 9 7800X. That is a $450 processor, 12 cores, 24 threads, 4.7 gigahertz base clock with a 5.6 gigahertz boost clock, 78 megabytes of total cache, and another 170 watts of TDP. Now, this is one of the reasons why the latest editions before the X3D of the Ryzen processor were kind of discounted or discredited, because they were really, really super hot. Now, you and I both know historically AMD processors might be a little bit less expensive, but they always demanded better cooling because they were
absolutely
hotter.
Well, and you know, very proprietary builds. Now, I like this chart also because it compares those four processors to the high end, well, at least the i9 and i7 from Intel.
Yeah, so these are the latest Raptor Lake. So we have the Core i9-3900K. This is the processor that I'm currently using on the test bench. It is a $580 processor. It has this hybrid core solution. So we have 8 performance cores, 16 efficiency cores, and 32 total threads. So it's a very large processor, but half of it only gets really activated when the load goes above a certain threshold for gaming and number crunching, stuff like that. Otherwise, it kind of runs in this idle state where it consumes considerably less power, gives off less heat, and you really don't notice a difference. In a way, it really becomes a lot faster because we have a lot more threads to go and handle the load.
Well, it's like the stop-start in a car, right? You don't use the power unless you need it.
Yeah, exactly. The difference here, though, is that the base clock is only 3 gigahertz, but I can tell you that the boost clock is almost always on. So it will go and tell you the boost clock, which is at 5.7 gigahertz, almost all the time. Even though it's not really doing anything, it just kind of ramps up. Now, the way that the Intel Boost works is that when it senses that it has a thermal headroom, it will boost the clocks as high as it can possibly go. And then once you get to that thermal threshold, it will start ramping the clocks down to make sure that it doesn't overheat itself, which is kind of nice, although it makes overclocking a really difficult task.
No kidding.
Now, the difference here also is that we have 68 megabytes of total level 2 and level 3 cache and 125 watts of TDP. If we go down to the Core i7 version, it's a $420 processor, 8 performance cores, 8 efficiency cores, total of 24 threads, 3.4 gigahertz base clock, which we know that the Core i7s and Core i9s have a different base clock, and it usually ramps up with fewer cores, whereas on the AMD side, it kind of ramped down, which was weird. But we have 54 megabytes of total level 2 and level 3 cache and 125 watt TDP.
Well, I know comparing AMD products to Intel products isn't really an apples to apples.
No.
But on paper, that Ryzen 9 sure looks good.
Yeah, it looks really, really tasty. Like, I think I would want to build something in this regard just because of the base clock alone. I mean, 4 gigahertz as the starting point of performance, that seems like it's going to be a pretty powerful processor.
Excellent. Well, I know we need to get a build like this going, but that's not really what I wanted to talk about too much. Although now you've got me kind of excited about a possible build here. But what I wanted to talk about, again, is to go back to the memory, because most folks, as they're upgrading, they're going to face a couple of major challenges. Mm-hmm. The motherboard needs to be changed, of course.
Yes. Motherboard.
And then this new RAM. Now, most people can get by if they already have a good enthusiast level system with just the rest of the parts they already have. But these are the core parts we're looking at. Of course, we don't want to talk motherboards because that's a completely, completely different. But let's talk about memory a little bit. So tell me a little bit about how these processors work with DDR5 and what should we, you know, why DDR5?
Well, I think what we're going to do is go to our friends at G-Skill. They have a great introductory guide to DDR5 DRAM memory. And this is stuff that I talk about in some of the reviews that I've done for this memory platform. Basically, what is DDR5? It's a faster version of DDR4.
That makes sense.
But there's a lot of architecture changes below that that make this change happen.
Okay. Now, hold on. Before we get too deep into this, I know there's also GDDR. What's the difference?
The G stands for graphics. And
okay.
It's actually the high-performance memory version. And that happens at a different cadence than desktop memory. So we have GDDR5, GDDR6, and those, while the numbers may correlate to the desktop side of things, they are generally one or two steps ahead. So we have like GDDR6 on the latest RTX cards, but on some of them you have GDDR5. And the difference there is that instruction sets and speed and basically the total performance of the chip is different. So with DDR5, much like when we had a change from DDR3 to DDR4, and that's something that I think we talked about on one of our early versions of the podcast, is basically we had DDR3, super, super popular. The speed had kind of topped out, and then the architecture changed, and then all of a sudden we have a major jump in performance. But between the two, we have really, really fast DDR3 and relatively slow DDR4, and the performance was almost identical. And it's because it was a stepping stone. There was just basically an architecture change that was implemented in the processor and motherboard configurations that warranted this change in the way that it was being addressed.
Okay. So a similar step must be happening right now with DDR5.
Yes. And the chart on the G-Skill website talks about DDR4, which was the base speed, the mega transfers, at 2133. That was basically the starting point for the megahertz, the speed, so to speak. With DDR5, it started at 4800. And if we look at the mega transfers per second, it's 6400 versus 3200 on DDR4. So it's basically doubling the speed just by changing to DDR5.
Excellent. Wow.
Now, of course, that speed is just the realization of how fast the memory is going or how fast it can handle the data transfer. We are still dependent on the processor and that interaction to determine how fast the entire system can go.
Right, but this is clicking with me now. When I purchase RAM, right, I'm looking for the fastest supported speed. So I usually look for, you know, DDR4-3200 or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with DDR5, you're saying we would be looking at -4800 up to, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, it's right now it's 8,000 is the
Holy
top.
Holy cow.
Which is pretty crazy. Now, of course, with DDR5, DDR4, and DDR3, the keys on the module will indicate whether or not that module will be able to be installed in your particular system.
So no backwards compatibility.
No, not so much. So you can't actually have an adapter for one or the other. However, with the first versions of the LGA 1700 motherboards, there was a DDR5 version of that board and a DDR4 version of that board.
Well, I remember when DDR4 first came out, there were some other boards that had a couple DDR3 slots and mm-hmm. a couple DDR4 slots.
Yeah, there was a bit of backward compatibility during that transition period, and that just basically allowed motherboard manufacturers to cater to different markets so they could offer the faster processor in an industrial setting that maybe is stuck with DDR4 memory, or they have a large investment and they're just looking to get the new instruction sets or something like that.
Well, it's a nice bonus if you already have good memory and you don't have the budget to upgrade both your motherboard and your RAM. But I think if I were shopping, I would want to go for a better single purpose board.
Yeah. Now, the next item on here was the higher module capacity. And this comes down to the density of the chips on the board. Now, in front of us, you'll have to use your imagination balls in your brain or something like that. But we have a series of Crucial Memory modules. These are all 16 gigabyte modules. They are single-sided, so we have chips on one side of the board. Now, if we take a 16 gigabyte module in the DDR4 realm, we would have chips on both sides because the module density, the density of the chip itself, was different.
Double-sided, double density, right?
And so to speak. But in this case, what we have is the ability to add higher density chips to individual modules to increase the capacity. And G-Skill is talking about a total capacity of 128 gigabytes.
Well, I think it's really interesting looking at these. And I know you did a review, so you might want to take a look. That the actual memory module itself is pretty bare. It only has like four chips on it, really. And then obviously some controller architecture, but there's like a lot of room on this to expand.
Yeah. And actually there's a total of eight. There's four of them under that sticker.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we can talk about the module because that's one of the next items on the G-Skill list is the onboard power management. So DDR5 requires only 1.1 volts of power to run. Considerably less power than what DDR4 required.
Yeah, that's nice.
Now, in the center of this module, we have chips on the left and chips on the right. At the very top, there's a small circuit with a bunch of resistors and stuff, capacitors around it.
Right.
That is the onboard PMIC chip. And that chip controls the voltage for the module. And what will happen is that when the module doesn't require a lot of activity, it will start to power down. So while you have 1.1 volts going to the module to make it run, it will go and start to reduce that amount when the system goes to sleep.
Smart.
Inversely, once you start ramping up the speed of your module, that circuit will start to generate heat. And some of the higher speed modules, they require a heat spreader to kind of spread that out and keep the module cool. But for the crucial modules, and a lot of DDR4 and DDR3 modules from way back when that always had a heat spreader on them, they're always qualified in terms of how fast they are without the heat spreader. So it's really more of a decoration, which is kind of an interesting anecdote.
Well, I guess for overclocking though, right?
Well, for overclocking, we like to have the heat spreaders on there, but in a lot of cases, getting memory to be too cold will slow it down and won't make it run as fast.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of interesting. So we talked about the lower operating voltage. DDR4 required 1.2 volts. DDR5 is at 1.1 volts. We're kind of getting that to the point where desktop memory is going to require at least 1.1 volts. So we won't be able to drop below that too much. But the onboard voltage module will start to control that a little bit more and make the system more efficient. And the last item on here is just basically talking about how we have 32 bank access, 8 bank groups, and that is really the memory architecture and the fact that it's able to handle more data at a single time. So it's able to process more data at once.
I think that's really interesting, actually. So we're seeing an improvement in efficiency, an improvement in power, an improvement in
speed,
an improvement in capacity. Yep. I mean, is there a negative to DDR5?
No, not really. Unless you start to take into account that it's at a cost for upgrading to a system that requires DDR5.
Obviously, of course, you've got to take into account the price of the motherboard and the processor if you're moving up.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a total package cost, obviously.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. If you mitigate the cost a little bit with your RAM, well, how much RAM or how fast RAM do you need? I mean, what's good enough?
Well, that is a really good question because I don't know if there's really a clear answer. And I'm going to refer to one of my reviews of the latest Crucial Memory here. So we have two modules. We have one that is at 5,600 megatransfers a second and 5,200 megatransfers a second. Now, the first edition DDR5 that Crucial sent out, they were one of the first companies to send me memory to review when Alder Lake was released. They were at 4,800 megatransfers a second. And that was kind of also that was on the tail of when Micron stopped the Ballistics line. So we don't have a gamer brand from Micron Crucial anymore, which is unfortunate. So we're going to be seeing basically the base model memory from them because that is what OEMs are after. That is what is fully supported by Intel and what's going to be supported by AMD and Ryzen.
Well, we've seen this before from companies like Crucial, right? This is where you start. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a market for it, then you bring out that high-performance RAM, right?
Right.
So hopefully that will come back around. Crucial, if you're listening, we love your Ballistics RAM. Don't go away.
Yeah. Now, I want to say that there was a reason that they did this. Now, the 5200 and the 5600 match perfectly with the Ryzen 9 release because that, according to AMD's website, is what is supported by the CPU. That's what it starts at.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in terms of actual performance, I have this based off of the Raptor Lake, so the 13900K. If we go and look at the 5600 against a previous edition Lexar module at 5200 megahertz, Cysoft Sandra, we have, 64 megabits per second versus 56 versus 75 when we have the Patriot Viper DDR5 at 6200 megahertz.
That's a nice scale, though, and it makes sense to me because we're seeing a pretty consistent curve or maybe a linear line in performance as we go up to the 6200.
Yeah. Now, I'll put a link to this review down in the show notes, so if you want to follow along, you can do that. Now, if we go down to the Ada 64 Extreme, we have a different set of benchmarks. So we have read, write, and copy. These are transfers within the memory itself, and then we also have latency. Now, faster memory is going to have lower latency. Slower memory is going to have higher latency. If we start with latency, we have 66 nanoseconds for the Crucial at 5600 megatransfers a second. We have 75 nanoseconds for 5200 because it's linear. And then when we get down to the 6200 from Patriot, it gets down to 60.3 nanoseconds. But if we go up to the read, write, and copy, we kind of see a similar story. So with the Patriot Viper, it's much faster. Lexar is kind of at the tail end of it, and Crucial is in the middle.
But again, it's a pretty predictable line. So you get a good idea of what you're getting based on the speed.
Yeah. Now, once we get into some gamerish benchmarks, that is where the story changes. So we have the Unigen Heaven benchmark, and this is primarily a video card benchmark that we used for benchmarking on HardwareBot. It has two modes, a DirectX 11 and a DirectX 9. Now, as we both know, being gamers, DirectX 9 relied mostly on the CPU to supply frames to the video card to play our games.
Exactly.
That would be like CSGO and stuff like that. But then when we get into Battlefield and some of the newer titles, most of the load is now on the video card. So we're not really looking for the speed of the memory and the CPU to go and help us play our games. Now, if we look here, we see that there is virtually no change across all three of these memory modules in the test system using the Unigen benchmark.
Well, that's really interesting because I'm looking at the numbers. And of course, there's a little bit of an increase in each one.
Yeah.
But I would have expected a much bigger variance, a predictable variance based on what we saw above.
Exactly. You know, if I'm going to quote some numbers here, we have our 5600 megahertz Crucial memory. DirectX 11 is 7451. DirectX 9 is, 10,187. Now, if we go to the Lexar Ares, which is 5200 megahertz, the speed actually jumps. It's 7554 and 9,939. So it actually goes down for DirectX 9, which is kind of what we'd expect, because there's going to be a change at the DirectX 9 level because it's more dependent on CPU and memory. Now, if we go up to the Patriot Viper at 6200, we have DirectX 11 at 7578, very similar number. DirectX 9 is now at that 10,157, which is slower than the Crucial module.
Huh. Well, it's very close, at least.
It's very, very close. I mean, at this point, we're kind of splitting hairs, but when we're using a competitive benchmark like that, every number and sub-number counts.
I think I'm seeing a pattern here, but what? One more, maybe?
Well, we'll do a couple more. We have the Babco Sysmark 25. This is a real-world benchmark that uses real applications, and it takes about 5 hours for it to run completely.
Oh, wow.
And it tests a variety of benchmarks in different scenarios. So we have productivity, creativity, and responsiveness. Now, responsiveness is primarily like a storage benchmark, but it's going to be looking at overall latency of the system and whatnot. The numbers that we're interested in are down here at the bottom, which is the overall. And for Crucial, we're at 1973. Lexar, we're at 1852. And the Patriot at 6200 is 1999.
I'm glad the 6200 is still a little bit ahead to justify that price tag, but again, those are pretty close numbers.
Yeah, and these is probably the best benchmark to represent real world what you're going to get if you put this in your system and enable the XMP profiles, which is kind of crazy, really. And then if we go down to our last benchmark, which is the UL PC Mark 10, we see the numbers kind of switch around quite a bit. So we have the Crucial module, the slowest as of them all, at around 8324. And then we have the Lexar at 5200 megahertz at 8542. It's actually a better number. And then we have the Patriot Viper at 6200, which is at 8897.
Okay, then. Well, correct me if I'm wrong here, but if I'm, at least from these last couple benchmarks, correct, then I'm not seeing a significant difference, assuming that you're not doing competitive, anything benchmark related, between the 5600 and the 6200. Obviously, there's a bit of difference.
Yeah, there's...
But, I mean, for the amount of money that you probably spend to make that jump, I really feel like you have to be a pretty serious enthusiast to jump into 6200 or I mean, have this 8000 stuff that's coming out. It's probably going to be even faster, but the increment is not that large.
It's not. And I want to say that some of this is because we have a new processor platform. We have software that's not able to take advantage of that new processor platform. And as you and I both remember, when DDR4 was released, there was a good 2-3 years when there wasn't a change or a reason to upgrade to the new system because our DDR3 machines offered the same performance. So what we'll see is that as this matures, DDR5 will really start to take off and will really run away in terms of performance. But right now, it doesn't make much of a difference.
So if I can translate that a little bit, right now, you're probably okay with really any good name brand DDR5 memory.
Yep.
But over time, the speed might have more of an impact. So let me ask this from a layman's term.
Sure.
How fast is enough today? What would you buy?
If it was me, I would buy something that is in the 52 to 6,000 range. That's what I like. And for DDR5, when I'm going to pick memory, I look at the speed. Obviously, you got to factor in costs. So you don't want something that's just going to completely blow the budget to the point where, oh, now I have to get a lower and slower video card.
Right.
You know, you don't want to do that. You don't want to look at your entire system as a whole. And we've mentioned this before. It's like, well, what's important? If you're playing AAA titles, it's going to be video card. So you're going to want to spend the most money on your video card. The rest of it, you can probably get by. And much like the DirectX 11 and DirectX 9 benchmarks that we just talked about, obviously it doesn't make too much difference. So obviously spend more money on your video card. But then look at the speed of your memory. As I mentioned, 5,200 to 6,000 is probably the sweet spot. And if you are torn between module speeds, look at the timings. You want to get the lowest timings available that still offer the same voltage. So speed, timings, voltage. Those are the things to look at.
Well, then the obvious second question, at least to me, is how much memory is enough? I mean, how many gigs should you be looking at to future-proof yourself to get the most performance out of your DDR5 system for gaming, productivity, I mean, you name it. If I'm building a new system today, I want it to last 3 years, 5 years maybe for some folks. I mean, how much memory is enough?
That is also a very good question because it really pains me to say that 32 gigs is the lowest amount that you're going to want to go.
And still?
And that seems like a lot. I mean, you know, in the DDR4 realm, it was 16 gigs. You know, you could get by, you could do anything with 16 gigs of memory. If you had 32 gigs, you were leaving a lot on the table because it wasn't being utilized unless you were doing number crunching or multiple applications at the same time. You know, not just web browsers, but we're talking like running Photoshop and a video editing software, something like that. But with DDR5, 32 gigs is really the entry point. Now, of course, 32 is the lowest point, and the sky's the limit, up to 128 gigs now. So
it sounds like if you have the latest Intel generation or this new Ryzen generation with DDR5, it's still safe to say that the hardware is pretty far ahead of the software.
Yeah, so much, in fact, that it's not really needed to upgrade, in my opinion. I mean, if you have a good, solid DDR4 enabled system and you like the performance, you could probably skip this generation, wait a year, and then think about upgrading. But, you know, as enthusiasts, we want to use and touch the latest and greatest stuff. So it's like, do your research, pick the best components, and go forth. For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS and follow us on Twitter. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2023. Thanks for listening.